Refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar, Refi Revival: Stay Ahead of the Curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely, data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Today is June 21st. July 21st. I want it to be earlier in the summer, but it's we're getting late in the summer already here. It's hot everywhere. Kids are out of school still. People are taking vacations, but still a lot going on, a lot to talk about. You know, in the interest of keeping everybody informed, we're always going to strive to bring you up to the hour current events and just things that we should be thinking about as originators and as hedgers and capital markets folks. So today we're going to do a market update with Alex here in a couple minutes. And then after the market update, we have a rare treat. You may or may not be familiar with Greg Scher, influencer on LinkedIn, also longtime originator, you know, runs a mortgage bank at this point, and it just has a lot of really good observations and advocacy around the industry. So Kevin and I will talk to him here in a few minutes. We just have him for a short time, but you know, in that time, we hope to get some guidance from him on what he's focused on and what we should be paying attention to as well. First, a little bit of data. OBMMI drifting a little bit lower, 6.74. So getting closer to that, you know, around that 6.5, 6.75 level. And actually seeing a bit of a rally this morning as well. So rates should be even a little bit better by the time this podcast comes out later today. Volume's still good and just seeing, you know, pretty good volume flowing through this summer, despite what some of the headlines might be telling you. All right, let's transition over to Alex, see what's going on in the market. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me, as always. Good morning. Alex,
chilling outside, getting some sun. Hear the birds chirping. That's not a bad deal.
I know. I was surprised how naturally these mics pick up a wide range of sounds. You might even hear some cars going by in the background. So
cool. Well, yeah. You know, quiet week coming up, but a few things to think about. But pretty good data last week, at least nothing earth shattering, right?
Yeah, nothing earth shattering. It was inflation week. So we got both CPI and PPI. CPI came in a little higher, back in the range we were seeing throughout last winter, north of 2.5%. CPI came in at 2.7% year over year. But the market reaction to that seemed to really just kind of take it in stride, you know, more so than anything. The market didn't freak out by it. And I think it really what it is everyone's expecting inflation to go up at this point, or at least even if they don't expect it to, they've been told that the market broadly expects it to go up, even if they personally don't think it's going to go up. And so again, it was really just taken in stride. We're still south of 3%, which is good. And then I think PPI, which was released the day after CPI, really kind of tempered any panic that there might have been out there among smaller circles in that regards to that 2.7 number, because PPI came in flat and still 2.5% year over year, which is right in the range that's been coming in for the past few months.
Yeah, it's just still a paradox, isn't it? You know, we're being told, and the math supports, you know, these tariffs have been out there for months at this point, not the enormous tariffs that were initially announced to kind of shock the system and bring people to the negotiating table, but there's certainly higher tariffs than we've had in many decades in effect right now. And you're seeing the surplus at the Treasury, they're bringing in that cash, yet prices, you know, have not broken north of kind of that 2.5 to 3% inflation number year over year. So it's being absorbed somewhere for the time being, or it's being worked around, or we're still waiting for it really to hit, right?
Right. I mean, you see the almost vertical line on the graph, or, you know, tariff revenues going into the Treasury this year. You know, they've raised already over $100 billion this year in tariff revenue. But yeah, prices at the checkout counter aren't much worse than the same time last year for the consumer. So, you know, what you have to imagine is that, as we've kind of talked about on the show multiple times now, is that for the time being, companies are just absorbing it themselves, just trying to be that last mover when it comes to finally having to price them forward into to the market, the counter. Yeah, for the time being, it's kind of just business as usual. You know, on the topic of tariffs, you know, we are approaching that August 1st deadline, which every member of the administration is saying is the final deadline. They're saying we'll continue to negotiate after August 1st, but all the numbers we've thrown out there will go into effect August 1st, and you'll begin paying those rates on August 1st. And, you know, we're still lacking deals with our largest trading partners. You know, China comes to mind. We've touched on them. They put together a framework back in April, but as far as I'm aware, Xi and Trump haven't personally signed off on it, which is what's necessary to get that framework into reality. Then kind of the EU is the major trading zone that we've been talking about, or the news has been talking about in the recent days. They're facing down 30% tariffs come August 1st. And some of their finance ministers were saying, you know, anywhere in the range of 15 to 20 would be pretty devastating to their export volume. So there's definitely, I think, you know, this goes for every country, but there's incentive to get a deal done. We'll see what gets done here in the next 10 days or so.
Yeah, so much good stuff comes from Europe too. I guess, and a lot of it's high-end stuff too. So I don't know, maybe that plays right into the narrative that we will just buy less stuff, but we'll pay more for it. But if you're talking about things like fine wine or I don't know, super high-end textiles, you know, maybe that's what was needed. I guess we'll find out what kind of deals we get done in this final 10 days.
Yeah, a lot of their agriculture is kept internal to the EU. But yeah, a lot of what we receive from the EU is higher value add items, like you said, those fine wines. I think the number one thing for me would probably be the auto sector. I think that'd be pretty devastating to specifically the German auto sector.
German cars.
BMWs, yeah. And Mercedes are very popular in the United States.
That's right. Okay, so more to come on that next week. I'm sure we'll be talking about the deadline quickly approaching. If there aren't deals done right by next week, I guess procrastination is in effect.
Yeah, seems to be, hopefully they get something done.
So otherwise, this week is pretty quiet, right? I mean, we'll continue hoping for some news headlines about tariff deals, and we're obviously looking forward to the Fed meeting next week. They're in the blackout period right now, but what else the rest of this week? Anything we should be paying attention to?
Nah, it's pretty quiet. I'd say, as I've been saying, keep an eye on those initial jobless claims. We saw that kind of spring back the last 2 weeks to closer to 225K, away from that 250 that we've been noting. This morning, we got the leading economic indicators forecast, which is just a collaboration of about 7 different economic outputs and forecasts. It technically showed us approaching a recession, but we'll see if that pans out. It's south of the 100 mark. So anything south of 100 is in, you know, an economic contractionary type environment. But yeah, aside from that coming out this morning, so that's already dropped. And then in addition to existing and new home sales, really, I just keep an eye on that weekly employment number. I guess on the subject of existing new home sales, we usually don't give it too much, you know, airtime, just because it's released so frequently. And again, it's a drop in the bucket at the end of the day. But we did see some headlines last week that new home builds, we saw some pricing cuts there. In fact, in June, 40% of home builders reported that they were cutting prices, which was interesting. You know, you and I were having a side conversation in one of our chats about, you know, what does this exactly mean? Because it seems that inventories are quite low, not at, you know, any sort of historical low for the past 5 years, but they do remain low. So if there's such a demand surplus, why are they cutting prices? And it seemed to be potentially that, you know, just new home builds are priced at a price point that just isn't affordable even for a relatively high demand environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's still an imbalance there, obviously. You know, it's and as of now, we're really just seeing, you know, in some markets, seeing a decline in home prices and at least a flat line in others. So we're not going to see those double digit increases year over year, but there does still seem to be a bit of a stalemate between the builders, between buyers and sellers in general, but especially with these new homes that are being built that are generally high end, as you've pointed out before. That's where the margins used to be historically for home builders was the higher end homes, but they're just not flying off the shelves anymore. The builders are not only having to pay big money to buy down rates for borrowers so that they can afford the payment, but now they're actually having to lower the price, the sales price of the home, which is further eating into their profits.
Right. I would say that's definitely a leading indicator for a potential downturn of sorts. I know we keep an eye on, you know, construction jobs in the home building industry, because that's been historically one that pulls back pretty early on. I would throw in price cuts to new home build, to completed home builds as well.
Yeah, and that number has finally started to pull back a little bit. The residential construction jobs, that's one that Logan Motoshami has pointed out as a kind of a leading indicator of potential recession, especially if the recession is led by the housing market. And just the rest of it, the narrative, as you mentioned earlier, you know, some of the leading indicators are technically showing, you know, recessionary signs or contraction signs, but there's so much noise today. You know, is it just consumers pulling back because of the unknown, because of the uncertainty? And that's what how a lot of people kind of wave off some of these more dour numbers that come out. It's just consumers being careful, and they're starting to bounce back by some measurements. And it's just seeing that with earnings too. This is a big week for earnings. If you do want to watch some other numbers come out that aren't, you know, like government printed economic numbers, there are some actual, you know, big corporations still putting out earnings right now. And those are generally showing signs of resilience as well. Just strong economic tailwinds is what it feels like, even though we have all this news that says that we really shouldn't be in a super positive environment right now, given all the noise going on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, bank and technology companies, which, you know, make up a large portion of, you know, that's where the U.S. economy is strongest, is in financial services and technology. Their earnings this season were quite strong. So I'm in agreement there. That I think there's a lot of static out there. I think just in regards to the news cycle and what tariffs specifically are going to do, I think we're well beyond the impacts of the government specific layoffs that we saw early in the year with Doge. But I think tariffs are really that remaining point of static that we're seeing in the data.
Right. Hopefully we get through that this summer. Otherwise, I think, you know, I'm still watching somewhat with morbid curiosity the continued drama around the Fed between Bill Pulte and President Trump and mostly just Jerome Powell just continuing to take a beating on social media. And you have to wonder what the end game really is, you know. And today I think it was, you know, Trump saying, no, Besant didn't talk me off the ledge. I still kind of want to fire this guy. And there's just a lot of, anyway, continued rhetoric around this. We've talked about it quite a bit, but it's still is very loud, I think, in the news and feels like there has to be a conclusion at some point, but I'm not sure what that's going to be.
Right. I think I was reading this morning about how Besant was saying we needed to, you know, kind of put the Federal Reserve, you know, as an institution under the microscope and look at its track record. He was saying, we've got all these PhDs over there. What's their track record look like, was essentially what he was saying. I think that more so than even just firing Powell is maybe not the best signal to be sending to the market pre-Fed or the United States, as we've gone over multiple times in the history of the Fed. There's been multiple iterations of the Federal Reserve. It's come in and out of existence, but in its modern, you know, incarnation, it's definitely, in my opinion, looking at the track record, while they're not always perfect on their timing, I think that they've been able to limit the scope of economic downturns. Because if you look at, you know, the history of the 19th century, when before this iteration of the Federal Reserve, very cyclical downturns that were quite deep. So the economy operated in a much different fashion back then. But I think you can see a distinct turning point with the Federal Reserves outside of maybe the Great Depression. But you were seeing, you know, approaching depression level pullbacks in the economy throughout the 19th century. So just something to keep an eye on in regards to a full review of the Federal Reserve. Yes.
Which has to be difficult, right? I mean, you basically have to compare how the Fed has helped or hurt the economy versus the alternate universe of what would have happened if monetary policy was done differently or not done at all, right? How would we have performed through the great financial crisis, if at all? What would the markets have collapsed during the initial days of COVID, right? Just to cite a few recent calamities that, looking back, we think the Fed saved us, and they probably did, but how could they have done better? And then with the resulting inflation that came out of, you know, the pandemic, how that's probably the thing they're going to focus on the most, because it's the most recent, had the most recent damage. And it's just the easiest one to pick apart, maybe because of the lingering effects of it. And the fact that timing is an issue right now for the White House as well. They think that we're behind the ball on cutting rates.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of timing, I think that seems to be their whole argument, is it's a timing issue. They're not exactly at odds with the tools that the Fed deploys. It's more so they're arguing that you should have, you know, cut rates a long while ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. More to come on that. If you're, you know, I don't really use Twitter, but occasionally I will look at it just for things like this. And it is probably the quickest way to get some of this news.
Yep. I have to keep myself off there, but
the rest of it is, it'll hurt. It's bad for your brain and your mood, but it comes out 6 hours before the news articles do on the traditional media outlets.
It absolutely does. It definitely helps you have an edge if you're simply following public figures.
Right. All right. Anything else, Alex?
No, that really covers everything. As I said, next week is the week I'm excited for. We're going to get a Fed meeting on Thursday. Everyone's looking forward to, not expecting any cuts there. More Fed drama. But in addition to that, the calendar falls really nicely. We're going to get the final week metrics, consumer confidence, GDP for Q2, PCE, the Fed's preferred inflation metric. And then Friday is the 1st of August. So we'll also get non-farm payrolls for the month of July.
Very nice. Okay. So slow week this week, but we're going to pick it up next week with a lot of good information. So we'll give you a fresh look at that here a week from today as well, before the party gets going.
Beautiful.
All right.
Sounds good.
Thanks so much, Alex. Enjoy the weather.
Thanks, Jim. Have a good one. Thank you. Man. Bye.
All right, gang. As promised, we have a real treat today. We're joined by Greg Scher, tens of thousands of followers on LinkedIn. If you don't happen to know Greg or follow him on LinkedIn, he's a major influencer in the mortgage industry and the housing industry and beyond. He's also a former radio host, which I thought was pretty cool, and a fellow podcaster. So welcome, Greg.
I appreciate you getting my name right. Most people pronounce it Sure. So you've done your homework. I appreciate it. Good to be with you.
Right on.
Yeah, great to have you, Greg.
Yeah, we thought it was just a good time to meet you. I get a rapport going and so we could collaborate, you know, even more in the future. But, you know, many of our listeners probably already know you. But in case they don't, can you just kind of run down all of your top occupations right now and generally what your mission is?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm the managing director of NFM Lending. So we're a top 12-ish retail only lender, meaning, you know, when you take out affinity groups and banks and lenders that have multiple channels, just retail only, we're somewhere around 12th in the country. And I handle marketing, business development, me and a couple of other people, the founder, the president and CEO, and our chief legal counsel, we sort of spearhead the efforts at the company. And I've been here a long time, about 16 years. And obviously, I do a lot online. Last couple of years, I've been much more present, particularly on LinkedIn. And I've been pushing advocacy, something that the late David Stevens, who I got to know really well, encourage me to do and to continue doing, because we just don't have that many voices in our industry at a C-suite level that are, for whatever reason, willing to step out and stand up for the entire industry beyond what's in between their own walls. So I just dipped my toe in those waters with several things, and it started to take off, and I started doing more. And the more I did, the more people came. So, and I've been doing that and trying to use my growing influence to encourage other people to join me. I'm a big fan of Kevin's and what he's been doing online. I told him very specifically the last time we talked that he's very thoughtful in his posts, does his homework. He's extremely intelligent. He won't step out unless he's got something really important to say that people should listen to. So, you know, I made sure to let him know that. And I want to encourage as many people like Kevin, like the next generation, to keep taking chances and to be brave and to stand up for this incredible industry that's done so much for so many.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Greg. Coming from you, who's, you know, industry icon, and, you know, right back at you in terms of, you know, putting the level of thought into your, you know, your post, the way you engage with people, the way that you drive conversation. I mentioned the way that I see your role on LinkedIn these days is you're sort of curating a virtual water cooler for the industry to have, you know, important, meaningful conversations. And the advocacy piece is, you know, is a huge part of that. I know, you know, a lot of folks have seen the hashtag All of Us. I'm curious about your shirt today, actually, another angle, or you got something.
No, this was given to me by someone in the industry. There's a lot of these. Okay. There's a lot of these going around.
Okay. All right. I'm going to do my homework.
I have my All of Us gear right here. I actually was thinking of wearing it, but, you know, I don't want to overwhelm or oversaturate with All of Us, right?
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the journey. So I'm sure folks have seen it, right? Hashtag All of Us. It's everywhere.
Yeah, it's been very successful. It was born from, ironically, I work at an IMB, but I was attending the Broker Action Coalition conference in Washington, D.C. about a year and a half ago. Katie Sweeney was running it at the time, along with Brendan McKay. And they were kind enough to invite me, I think largely because I had been talking about All of Us. I had not memorialized it, like officially with a hashtag or anything like that, but I had talked about this idea of let's stop fighting one another. Let's start fighting for the reason we all got into the industry, and that's to help as many consumers as we can. So I was standing there in the audience, and I was listening to Katie and Brendan interview these people, and they were talking about things that are important to every one of us in the industry, all of us, how veterans are treated, credit scoring, all these different abuses that are in the industry and headwinds that face us. And I just thought to myself, wow, they're talking about the same things that everyone's talking about. This is about all of us. I'm going to start using that hashtag and try and bring as many people together as I can. And it worked. I stepped out and started using it. And then ever since, there have been a lot of people that have used it. We've got some really cool t-shirts made and sweatshirts and hats, and it's taken on a life of its own, and I love it. And I think we really can make an impact as when we're unified. And I believe that what's going on with VantageScore being introduced into the mainstream by FHFA, I can't prove this, but I believe that the All of Us movement had a lot to do with it. The NBA obviously has the Mortgage Bankers Association. They've got a great relationship with FICO. Can't blame them. You know, they're a sponsor and they're important to the industry, right? The credit scores are the lifeblood to get us to a closed loan. So they really weren't stepping out a lot on that. I think it was delicate. And the minute we all started to coalesce around this idea of, come on, enough is enough. Where's your voice? Stand up. The NBA started to get more vocal. Maybe it's a coincidence. I mean, they would claim that they were saying things all along. Now, they were making comments like, you know, we'd like somebody to look into this. You know, what is the justification of these costs? Fortunately, I don't have to straddle that politically correct line. Look at all of these costs. Nobody can explain it. You've got the right hand blaming the left hand. Who's responsible? Who's culpable? Let's raise the volume on this. Some and Bob Brokesmith, the president and CEO of the NBA, started to speak up more about it. And then former director of the CFPB, Rohit Chopra, talked about it at a conference. And now everyone's talking about it, right? Senator Hawley started talking about it, and people are outraged. And then it gets to the desk of Bill Pulte, the FHFA director, and suddenly he's talking about it. And before you know it, VantageScore is accepted now by the agencies. Now they're accepted, meaning it's a green light, but you can't really drive the car through the intersection yet because there's so much to set up. You've got to get the MI companies ready to go. You've got to get the system set up. Really, IMBs aren't set up yet. Like we're waiting for the call from the bureaus who are going to be the ones to facilitate getting it ready. And then you have the agencies, which they say they accept it, but how is it packaged?
There's no guidelines.
Will the secondary market have an appetite for the Vantage scores? And now what you have...
Pricing.
Yeah, pricing. And now you have, you know, do you need one report, two report, both at the same time? Bi-merge, tri-merge? Did the cost just double? There's so many more questions than answers. All this to say that I believe had we not gotten together as an industry to elevate our voices, I'm not sure we're at this place right now. Again, it's not something you can prove, but it gives me a lot of wind beneath my wings to keep speaking up. And it should give a lot of other people wind beneath their wings to continue to do the same thing.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, competition is coming. That's the message too, though, with the FICO score piece is, and once we figure it all out, that it was an area where I think everybody who heard about it wasn't familiar with our industry realized that there's actually a business that sort of has a monopoly on credit. You know, maybe that's a strong word, but certainly there was not any competition there for a very long time.
It is a monopoly. It wasn't.
Maybe, yeah.
It's been a monopoly. I mean, a monopoly, they've got all the market share. They know it. They can keep raising prices because they're the only game in town. There's no limit. There's no policing. There's no governors on that. That's a monopoly. That's what that is. So yeah,
yeah, that just wasn't.
Step out, man. Come on, let's go. Monopoly.
No one took the opportunity to compete with them. And now they felt empowered to do that. And then the Vantage score comes to the forefront.
I think Vantage score has wanted to be, I mean, there was something called the Credit Competition Act, which was passed by Trump and his administration in it was introduced in 2018, and then it was passed in 2019, and it was the responsibility of the FHFA director at the time, Mark Calabria, to get that moving and to enter that into the mainstream. It never happened. They ran out of time, and the Democratic administration came in, didn't do enough, in my opinion, overall in housing. And, you know, so it's being reintroduced right now. But I think, you know, Vantage Score has been around for some time. They're well adopted in other verticals. Credit cards, car loans, a handful of like the Bank of New York, you know, the home loan banks. There's five of them now, Dallas, San Francisco, and a couple of others that have been using Vantage Score, but they're also portfolioing. So anybody can step up and say, I want to compete. It doesn't, none of it matters unless the agencies will.
The GSEs accept it.
Yeah, unless they accept it and say, all right, enough is enough. And the Biden administration didn't really do anything about it. They didn't seem to care.
And so Greg, if we take Vantage Score and we, you know, sort of dig into that story a little bit, I'm curious, you know, it kind of goes back to the bigger question is how do you affect meaningful change within the industry? And I'm curious your thoughts on the role that, you know, the online conversation versus the offline conversation plays in it. Is it something where, you know, the nuts and bolts are really happening offline, or the online conversation drives what's happening offline? Like, what's your take on that?
When it comes to Vantage Score?
Yeah, when it comes to Vantage Score, and I think even just more generally, like affecting meaningful change. But let's take Vantage Score as an example.
You know, it's hard to move the ball down the field when you've got politics involved. I think we all know that. But social media, I think, is becoming more and more powerful. So the conversations all happen in the back room. And then to answer your question, it starts back there with strategy and whiteboarding and how do we get this through? And then like an entity like Vantage Score was doing everything they were supposed to do. They were trying. They did a test of 45 million closed loans, Fannie and Freddie, to see how their score modeled out, and they submitted it by the deadline. FICO never did, right? Then Vantage Score started to develop some relationships with people that are out there on social media. I'm one of them. You know, I got to know Jeff Richardson, who runs PR for them, and Tony Hutchinson, who runs policy. And I started to hear their story and to dig into it. And that's when I felt confident enough to really elevate the case for Vantage Score. So to answer your question, it starts in boardrooms. It starts whiteboarding. It starts with doing what they can do. But then when it comes to politics, obviously, it's very hard to get anything done. So you hit a wall and then you need the advocates to come in and start speaking up so that more people hear it. It's elevated. Things get shared. And particularly in this administration, like Bill Pulte, whether you like what he's doing or not, he's all over X. So, I mean, what I've done, what I'm in the process of doing is redoing my X page because I had never been active on Twitter. I'm a horse racing fan. I would like replay the Kentucky Derby and other things on there. But, you know, I didn't really use that as a vertical to say who I am and what I do and what I'm passionate about professionally. So I'm so encouraged that he's looking, that Mark Calabria is looking, who's very active on X, and potentially even the president is looking, that I'm redoing my X page so I can start to put stuff out there that is important to our industry, which is a perfect segue into what I've been posting about the last 2 days, which is this report by the National Association of Realtors, which shared that in the last 12 months, you know, or April to March, April of last year to March of this year, something like 78,000 properties were purchased in the United States by foreign entities. And so, you know, yesterday I said, you know, enough of this shit. And then today I backed that up with some stats, you know, and also not just stats, but talking about China's policy. And I'm not picking on China, but you can't do there what they can do here. And there it's one house at a time. You can only have one house. It's a leasehold, not a freehold. You have to live there for 12 months before you can buy anything. Meanwhile, in the United States, there are no limits. Do whatever you want to do. Hey, I don't care where you're from. You got cash, you're good. You get the same rights as our citizens. Meanwhile, we have a surplus problem. We have an affordability problem. And every time these foreign entities come in and are willing to pay more than anybody else, what do? They drive the price up. What does that do? It hurts the affordability. So kind of goes hand in hand.
So yeah, I certainly appreciate your call out for people to get out there and be more vocal and more brazen. I think that social media has worked kind of both ways with everybody, where I think some folks are worried about very conscious in what they say out on social media, because there is this idea that you can get canceled, or that there's a lot of risk in that. If you say the wrong thing, that can go viral against you. But I also think that is a problem, right? Because people are afraid to say things that might be controversial. And I do appreciate that you get out there with a lot of great observations and takes on things that may be controversial or not. You know, I'm sure you have at least half of the people that hear it agree with it. And I would bet that more of your followers than that agree with it. And these are great topics we've brought up already.
You can't worry about that. I feel like as long as I'm coming from a genuine place and that I don't have a self-interest behind it, you know, and I marry that with doing as much homework as I can, that I'll end up okay. And certainly, I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that read what I write and go, you know, what an a-hole, like, can't stand that guy. And that's cool. People can turn the channel, right? I'm trying to help the industry out. I'm 54. I've been in this industry for 27 years. I stumbled in it by accident, and I'm in what I call the legacy phase of my career. What can I do to bring along the next generation? What can I do to inspire people and leave the industry in a better spot than that I found it, in particular in the last couple of years? So I'm sort of feel like I've been rejuvenated a lot. And, you know, I want people to follow me on LinkedIn. You see my name, Greg Scher. You know, go to LinkedIn, look me up, you know, follow me, ask to be connected, and I'll accept your request and agree or disagree. Like, I just want to create, and I love the way Kevin puts it, a water cooler for important topics in the mortgage business. And I'll spend 30 minutes, an hour offline with someone that wants to learn how to do what I'm doing. And I can tell you that in order to make an impact, you have to do the things that I just mentioned. You have to be fair, balanced, no self-interest, do your homework. But there are other fundamental things that you need to do. You need to be consistent. You can't be a helicopter poster where you come in and dump something, a topic in, and expect that everyone's going to look at what you have to say. You also have to go into other people's comments or posts and make a lot of comments, show up, be accounted for. And if you do those things, I just gave you the ingredients to being able to influence in a very positive way an industry that you care a lot about.
That's a great roadmap.
Yeah. And just, you know, I think the consistency piece is really important, you know, like being visible, kind of reminding people that you're there, you've got things to say, you've got your own thoughts. I think that's great advice. I'm curious on the topic of advice, you know, one of the big things that you talk about is mentorship within the industry. Outside of kind of the things that we've been talking about here, posting more or, you know, being more visible, using your authentic voice, what big pieces of advice do you have for folks who are kind of making this industry their home and want to grow or get to the next level?
Well, let me take this in a different direction, because I think I did just answer that question. I mean, I've just gave the roadmap. So if you rewind this and you listen to what I said, I told you how to go about it, you know, how to think about things, do your homework, post consistently every day, every other day, get in other people's threads, comment, whether you agree or disagree, like that is the roadmap to anyone that wants to elevate. I just gave it to you. So go back and listen to what I said. I will say that something that I'm very passionate about, an opportunity, I think, is to elevate more women in our industry. We have some incredible women. Many of them are afraid to speak up because it's a male-dominated industry. And part of what I champion is the women in our industry and doing what I can. You know, I encourage my good friend, Jennifer Beeston, who's a, you know, the top VA purchase lender in America, to get up on stage with me at Housing Wire. She had never been on a stage like that. And she was up there with me at the gathering and I interviewed her. And I'm going to champion her, our own chief legal officer, Latasha Wadi. I encouraged her to get on stage. She had never been on that stage before. She wrote a book largely because of a group that she was in being mentored by the great Patty Arbiello. And so I encouraged Latasha to get up on stage. And so I think we have a responsibility as, you know, it's us in numbers by a lot. And you listen to Empower and what Marsha Davies is doing at the NBA. You want to be a great leader, advocate for our women. Give them the courage, give them the fuel, give them the permission, not that they need it, but, you know, support them, encourage them, and push them out onto more forums like this, more stages, because I'm biased. I mean, I owned a mortgage company prior to coming to NFM, and every person in leadership was a woman. And I just know that there's a lot of pent up impact, more impact that they can be making if they just feel comfortable. And it's a real thing. Like I talk about permission and things like that, that women don't need any permission, but part of the perceptions, part of the bias is that whoever they work for, I mean, Marsha talks about this like in conference rooms. A lot of women are afraid to speak up because they've got, you know, males that come over the top, cut them off, do things like that. Like we got to work at being better there. So that is an opportunity. You're asking me for how people can elevate, get behind the great women in our industry if you're a man, and push more women out in the limelight, because they're going to, a lot of the greatness in our industry is because of the women that are in it. And we need to tell that story more.
Hear, hear. Yeah, it's definitely an issue that's been in our industry, you know, beyond the 100-year history of mortgage banking and in the finance industry in general. I think there's not nearly enough women. And I think you're right about the reasons for that.
Yeah. And I know a lot of the women in your great company, and appreciate what Optimal Blue does. You guys, I think, you show up, you know, you go to industry events, you support the industry in a big way. I've sat across from several people in your organization, women at functions, and just keep doing what you're doing. You know, I love this idea that you're out here, you know, on this podcast talking about things that are relevant to the industry and really putting a different, more thoughtful spin on the things that you talk about. And I went back and looked at a bunch of your podcasts, and you guys really do a great job. You're not just out there talking about the normal run of the mill stuff. You're very thoughtful. I mean, even in this, Kevin approached me and said, "Hey, you know, what do you think about this?" And you presented five topics, and then I got on the phone with someone in your organization to talk about how it might look once we got on the podcast. So that's like 2-3 steps beyond what most people do to get prepared, and that's how much you care. So, you know, hats off to Optimal Blue.
No, we appreciate that. And hey, you know, really appreciate you coming on, Greg. It's been great getting to know you more and just following the things that you're talking about. You know, always look for that. What's that next big topic that you're sinking your teeth into? So I'm following what you're talking about with foreign ownership of housing in the U.S. and very interested to see where that conversation goes.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for the support. And this is a great opportunity for me and for the industry. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Greg. Great conversation.
Pleasure. Let's do it again.
All right. Let's wrap this thing up. Big thanks, Alex, Kevin, and Greg. Really had a good time talking to Greg. I particularly appreciated the conversation about the lack of women in our industry. I do think we're missing opportunities there to hire more strong, brilliant women. But that's why we're talking. You know, we can always do better. That's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thank you for tuning in to Optimal Insights.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions? Or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.